Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. Thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. So this is the night of the two Matts, Matthew Quirk, Matthew Goldman, who writes as Matt Goldman. I thought it would be really fun to have a double Matt night all the way around. I am a serious fan of both of their work, and I'm pleased to say that we have talked all of your books here.
All of them, yeah.
And I think, Mr. Quirk, we've done the same, right?
Yeah.
You have to hold that up.
Oh, yeah, going on 10 years now, yeah.
I know, right. So you were actually here for The Night Agent.
Yeah, every book.
Right. Yeah. And so The Night Agent, for those who are not paying attention, was the number, maybe still is, the number one show on Netflix. And I know, really great.
Thank you, Aaron.
And, thank you very much for your enthusiasm. And Matt has a, which he can tell you about, Matthew, a background in Washington, D.C. and Washington, how it works and so forth, that you're able to use in The Night Agent. And now you're using in Inside Threat. I noticed that they woke up and noticed about The Night Agent, having ignored it for a long time by putting a sticker on the book.
Oh, yeah. And then we didn't get the art quickly enough from Netflix to make a tie-in for The Night Agent paperback.
So oh, right. Yes. Done... When there's a TV sale, they take the whatever the film company has devised, and they use it for a new book cover. And that works only as long as it's on television, and then nobody cares after that, and they go back to the old cover.
So they made a digital one, but it doesn't exist in the world.
That's creepy.
You know, so you can see it on Amazon for the audio book. And then people say, well, send us a copy of that one. I said, there is none. There is no one.
Well, publishing's full of interesting anomalies and timing. So we will come back to that. Matt Goldman has written three books about a Minnesota PI, except the last one. Is it four?
Four, yeah.
But this one isn't.
No, the last two are standalones.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love his suburban suspense. Now, I have to ask you, because I don't know, is it pronounced Edina or Edina?
Edina.
It is Edina.
Yes. The audiobook person apparently didn't get that message, so that's been corrected. Every book for the audiobook, and I'm sure, Matt, you get this too, they send you a pronunciation guide. First of all, I typed back how to write everything in the first book, and they got a lot of it wrong. So after that, I made audio files and sent it to them. And about a week before A Good Family was to be published, I realized, they never sent me a pronunciation guide. And I called my agent, and she said, don't worry, it'll be okay. And the day the book was published, I started getting emails about the mispronunciations. So they are going to fix it. Yeah, you know, when you live in Minnesota, there's a lot of words that can be pronounced wrong.
I don't know that it's pronounced wrong, but there's no real guide to whether it's a, you know,
well, it is Edina in
eye.
Scotland, and same spelling, and it's Edina in the States. Yeah.
That's like Prairie du Chien, Iowa, or Versailles, Kentucky, you know, where the French would throw up at the thought of it being Versailles, Kentucky. So I love it. Anyway, Matt's wonderful book, A Good Family, takes place in Edina.
Edina.
Got it wrong. Okay, in Edina, Minnesota. And it has Matt, I think, really great at the twist in suspense novels. So you think you're reading about one thing as you're moving along through the story, and then at the end you discover that you're not, which we're not going to be able to tell you about, because otherwise, why would you be here? But I thought that this one was particularly interesting.
Thank you.
I've been talking it up to fans of authors like Megan Miranda and all, who really like that kind of a suburban, small-town suspense. Polly Stewart was another. You were a focus of a conversation I had with Polly and Megan, yeah. After which they both went out and ordered your book. So
that was nice.
All right, so we'll start with you. Want to talk about Inside Threat?
Sure, yeah. This threat, this book is... comes from a premise that I've been kicking around for forever. And the idea is the president comes under attack at the White House, and they take him to this real life place called Raven Rock, which is this doomsday bunker built under a mountain near Camp David. and then they lock him inside. And the idea for the book was, well, we'll lock him inside with the most trusted people in government. They all have this special clearance called Yankee White, which is the clearance you need if you'll have the president's life in your hands. And then you lock them in, and then a body turns up, and then you realize that he's locked inside with the threat. Yeah, I thought it would be so easy because you just lock him in and then you're off to the races. But it turns out the locked room mystery or thriller is like really challenging because you can't kind of like pull things out of nowhere.
Once you locked them in, you had to work out how to get them out
because of all the constraints. And because everything needs to be kind of like in the setting from the start, and you need to account for everyone at all times. So it's kind of tricky to pull off, but I love the premise being that that kind of contained, and you know, it's a little bit like my homage to kind of Die Hard with a little Agatha Christie in there too.
Oh, I love that. So is this a Secret Service operation once again?
Yes. So it's the two leads are, and this was interesting to me because I started with the premise, and so the characters had to sort of reveal themselves over time. And the two leads are Secret Service agents. One is older and a little disillusioned, which kind of comes naturally from being in the Secret Service forever because you're closer to politics than anyone else besides maybe a spouse. And you kind of see everything, but they also have this kind of objective, like they see nothing except threats, you know, because they're not there to judge anything. And so he's a little disillusioned. And then his partner died in the line of duty taking a bullet for the president. The main character also was shot in that incident. And the book starts with his dead partner's daughter showing up for her first week on the White House detail. And so they have a lot going on because he's, you know, wants to protect her. He has a lot of unresolved stuff about the partner, and she has a lot to prove, and has been sort of thinking about getting back into the Secret Service for her whole life. And the last time he saw her was when she was 12, getting like a folded flag at his dead partner's funeral. So, and then you lock him in with the president in this intense situation, and it's kind of a crucible. So I was really happy with how the characters and all these relationships just kind of burbled up and developed.
Where did you get all your knowledge about the Secret Service?
Well, there's a guy named Chris Albanese. I think it's, I haven't heard his last name pronounced, but he's a friend of mine through book stuff, and he actually went to my high school. He and I chat about stuff, so I got like some good research on that. And then the stuff about Raven Rock, this like secret doomsday facility, which is, do you remember when you'd see that a politician went to like an undisclosed location? That was Raven Rock, and it's effectively a defense department. It's bigger than the Pentagon, actually, with a big war room, and it's built under a mountain. My friend wrote a book about this, a nonfiction book, which was like the closer on Raven Rock and doomsday plans. And I had this bunker idea for a long time. And then my friend Garrett Graff, he writes all these great books. He was just a Pulitzer finalist for his Watergate book. He writes a whole book, and I'm like, well, I think I have the research done for my bunker book. So I, you know, kind of pulled in from his book and then talking to folks.
And it's good you're not the one who gave away the secret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happened at the Greenbrier.
Oh, really?
There was one under a resort in West Virginia.
That's right. No,
and a
it is
journalist
not.
Exposed it, and then they said, all right, open it up for tours. We can't use it anymore.
I thought, didn't they use the Greenbrier room during the war, during World War II? I think they did.
I don't know if they ever...
No, I've been to the Greenbrier and actually toured it. I'm pretty sure that they did use it during the war.
I'm sure they used it for something. I don't think they ever used it like for its intended purpose, which was the Congress would go there if Washington exploded under a nuke. But it was a very well-kept secret. There's one called Mount Weather for the president. And then there's one called Raven Rock near Camp David for the DOD. And then there's another one for the Congress, which they don't really talk about where that is now. Since
I probably shouldn't. I
mean, yeah, that's a good idea.
Giving away all of our national secrets.
Surely part of the point was that it was secret. Yeah. But didn't you use a bunker in The Night Agent? I mean, when we get to the end, there is a, you know, a locked room part.
I'm trying to. So the show has a bunker.
Right.
And
that's, but sorry, you're right. It was the movie. Right?
And then the show has a bunker, but there wasn't a bunker in the book. It was kind of a different ending. There was, it was like an above ground facility.
Okay. But in the movie, the TV,
they did
use it.
You know, when you have these like chess pieces for your presidential thriller, you're going to end up in a bunker, you know,
like, got it.
It's one of the moves.
Was this where they wanted Pence to go? On January 6th, did they want, you know, because he fought being removed. And I thought they were talking about taking him to at least what they call a, quote, secure location. But that might have been the Mayflower on the fourth floor or
something. Well, they have a lot. And the one that came up in January 6th, because they built a new visitor center at the Capitol. Yeah. And it was like a big cover for building a giant bunker for Congress under the Capitol. So if you saw some of the January 6th like cell phone footage from people, they went to their undisclosed location, like under the Capitol, which is new. So I don't know where they would have taken Prince. There's one under the White House, which is very small. It's like the size of a conference room. And then there's these other three. And I'm sure they have safe places like closer in D.C. too.
Why do we even know this? I mean, I think that's really fascinating that it would even be public knowledge, don't you?
I do. I am fascinated. Yeah. And worried we're all going to be hauled away after this. Yeah.
It's true. We probably shouldn't be talking about. There is a theme that carries over a little bit into
but we
a
can't
good
talk
family,
about it.
But we
yeah.
can't talk about it, right? But these books pair up even better than you might think.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, now I'm scared to say it. Edina, right?
Edina.
Okay, thank you. Edina, Minnesota.
Yes,
so,
which is a real place.
Right. Yeah. And you are a native of Minnesota? Where
I
are you
am
from?
A native of Minnesota.
Right. I was confused. Brian Freeman has just fled Minnesota for Florida.
Oh, he did?
Yes, he did. So I'm thinking
he's
more
Minnesota.
He
must be making too much money now that he's writing the
Ludlow
books, so he doesn't want to pay taxes. That's just a guess. He might be going for the weather. That's also possible.
Well, I would think if you lived in Minnesota that you might go for the weather.
Yeah.
But I'm from Chicago, and I'm here for the weather.
The winters are, especially the last two, have been quite unpleasant.
Right. So anyway, what made you decide to set a standalone suspense novel in Edina, Minnesota?
A couple of things. There's this neighborhood. It's set in a neighborhood called Country Club, which is the name of a neighborhood, even though there is an actual country club nearby. And it's really a lovely neighborhood with sidewalks and big houses. And if you've ever seen a John Hughes movie like Home Alone, that's in Chicago, but it looks like that. It's really quite nice. And about this time of year, if you're in Minneapolis and you're driving around, there are dandelions everywhere, in every park, in everybody's yard, even though they try to get rid of them. They're either the yellow kind or the dead kind that are fluffy and will spread seeds all over. And one day during that time, I was driving through, cutting through the country club neighborhood of Edina to avoid another intersection. And I noticed there was not one dandelion, not one in the whole neighborhood. And it just made me wonder what kind of energy do you have to put in to maintain that kind of facade of perfection? And so I was thinking about that. And I was also, when I was a baby writer in Hollywood and working on TV shows, I worked with people who were making several million dollars a year and had to, not because they were overextended, but because their egos would not allow them to make less money. And they were miserable. Their families were falling apart. They were grumps all day long. They were really in this rotten place, and they had plenty of money, but they had to make more. They had to keep making more. And I don't know if that's an American phenomenon, and I know it's not true for everybody, but there is this feeling like there has to be more growth. This, if a company's not growing, it's not doing well. I remember during, I think it was Halloween, there was an interview with the company that makes all the candy corn. I think it was the candy corn. It might have been a different holiday, and it might have been candy canes, but I think it was candy corn. And it was on NPR, on Marketplace or something, and they said, why don't you go public? And the CEO of the company said, because if we have a bad quarter, we'll just have a bad quarter. But if we go public and we have a bad quarter, we'll all get fired and they'll change the whole business and wreck everything. And so there's just kind of this obsession with growth. And then what happened with Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes, who was just went into prison. I'm just fascinated by her. And she was at Stanford. She was going to have a life where she made millions of dollars, but she had to make billions. And so those kind of things all just swirled together, and it's really kind of the foundation of a good family.
Which is really just a terrific book. Unfortunately, we can't talk about most of the really terrific features of it, which is so annoying.
Most of my first five books have had a dead body or a missing person pretty soon, and then you try to find out who did it. This book is more of a woman named Katie, who's married to this guy, Jack, starts to notice that things are weird. Like this little weird thing happens and that little weird thing happens. And it's kind of an onion peel until it gets bigger and things get bigger and weirder and bigger and weirder as you go. So that's why it's hard to talk about one of the things without revealing too much.
It's also an interesting novel about female friendships in a community like that. Whether they're real, whether they're toxic.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of betrayals in the book, but it's hard to spot them. Good job.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So let's go all the way back to your first book, because it had one of the best premises ever for, so tell us about it.
Well, my first book is called Gone to Dust, which just was re-released in trade paperback. Good. Did they send that to you?
Probably not.
Oh, man.
I know.
And it's got a cool new cover, but it starts with a crime scene. A woman is found murdered, and her body and most of the house is covered in the dust and dirt from hundreds of vacuum cleaner bags. So there's so much hair and DNA samples and fibers in there that there's no usable forensic evidence.
Isn't that brilliant? I just love that. You know,
the police.
Here you know, if you want to kill somebody. First, collect vacuum bags.
Yeah. So that the people asked how I thought of that, and I said, well, I hate the show CSI. And so I wanted to think of a crime they couldn't solve, which is partially true. But the other thing is I wanted a crime that couldn't be solved in the lab, because this suburban police department that's inexperienced with murder then has to bring on a consultant, which is the whole reason to introduce my private detective, Neil Shapiro. And because there's no forensic evidence, he has to draw on his life experience to gain insight into the investigation, which gives us a reason to learn about his life and get to know him. And I'm a firm believer in character is more important than story. And so that was a way to get to know Nils and what he's been through in the world and how he gains insight into that no usable forensic evidence crime.
I think it would make absolutely terrific television. I love the idea of seeing this scene, you know, gray dust everywhere and this kind of lump underneath it all. So, you know, has there been any interest in it?
There has been some interest. Nothing's happened. There was an option. And you know, those things are sometimes work out, sometimes they don't. Having written a lot of television, that I was never impressed by the option, because I've optioned things and knew they had almost no chance of going forward. But we'll see. You know, after the strike, nothing's going to happen right now. But
great.
Yeah.
I love it. So, I mean, the private investigator is making something of a comeback. And, you know, with all the dazzling forensics we have, I think it's wonderful to read something where dazzling forensics are not actually going to work. That's hard. That's kind of like your locked room problem. You got the guy in the bunker, and then there you are. So how are you going to solve a murder if there is no forensic evidence is the problem here.
And, you know, so many of these books, like, if you wanted to be strictly accurate, it would get kind of boring, you know? So it's nice to contrive a way that it can get back to some of the gumshoe stuff.
What was your actual career in Washington? What gives you the background, the part you can tell about, or are you still part of the Official Secrets Act or something?
No. I mean, I was a junior reporter at The Atlantic. And so... got a really nice background in, you know, foreign affairs and espionage. And
hidden
stuff like
bunkers.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so some of it was through work, and then some of it was just kind of the atmosphere, because I went there actually between junior and senior year of college to be an intern. And I didn't really know much about politics or foreign affairs. And the new owner of The Atlantic magazine where I worked, he had just sold a healthcare company, and then he kind of hired people, and he was used to having people working for him. And so it was this moment where I suddenly had access to this guy, and he was this like fascinating Washington figure, because he lived in the former Cuban embassy, which was like on Embassy Row, and he would have salons like you would have with, like, was it Joe Alsup and the Kennedys kind of thing, you know? And then it would be like a former CIA director, and they would be debating whether the U.S. should be an imperial power. And I was just trying to remember which, you know, fork to use. So it was this like great introduction to D.C. And at the same time, because the Iraq War was about to start, everybody knew it was going to start, but it hadn't yet. And there was like, there were spies and foreign agents kind of angling to be installed in power. And you'd go to your friend's house who wrote about that stuff, and you'd be drinking beer with these guys. So it was just this really neat introduction to, you know, politics and foreign affairs. And I always had a writing bug and had always loved thrillers, but lots of different kinds of books. And that really made me realize, like, oh, this is the stuff I should be writing about. And that gave me also the material and some of the contacts I would later use in these books.
The 500 was your first book, and it was a huge success. So what got you to writing it?
Well, that, I mean, I just loved writing, and I was writing like short stuff for the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And that book, I reread it because some things are happening with that in like TV film land. And it was a trip because it was so personal and so kind of autobiographical, because I had gone from like public schools in New Jersey to Harvard and then to this really genteel magazine and kind of access to these people. And I felt like a fish out of water. And I used a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And you know, for a book, you sex everything up. So it was a guy who came from a family of con men, and you know, everything is much higher stakes, but it was, you know, his Jeep with no shocks was my Jeep with no shocks. Like the first kiss with my wife was the first kiss with the female lead in the book. So it was really interesting to go back and read, because it was really a lot of just my experience in DC, and it was written in first person, so it sounds like me. It was a really funny experience to go back to. It was like reading an old journal in some ways, you know.
So I said we would talk a little bit about script writing and going for television. And the 500, as I remember, was optioned. It was a really big, but somehow or other never materialized.
That's how it works, you know. And,
right.
And then you see somebody make a show and it costs like $50 million at the low end, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
And so when you're asking somebody to do that, they're looking for reasons to say no. You want to really make sure it's a good investment. So most things I've had optioned don't work out ultimately. And that's just, it's good to have it happen a couple times, because then you expect it and then you're not like too chagrined when it happens. It's just kind of how it works.
Why do you think the Night Agent suddenly got adapted and cast and all the rest of it?
I think, you know, for any of these things to go all the way, it's like has to be just a quadruple bank shot. I think it's just because it's such a good book. It's my sheer animal talent. No. So that was a situation. That book went around town, got rejected by everybody, and my, not rejected, like Nibbles, and then, and my my film agent loved it, and he gave it to a guy named Jamie Vanderbilt, who wrote White House Down, who just loves stories like that. And they optioned it, and I thought, okay, you know, we'll see. But it wasn't one of these options like with the 500 where they kind of like blow the doors down on the option. And then he gave it to Sean Ryan, who was had a story that didn't feel like a full TV show, and he thought he could combine them. And then suddenly we had Sean Ryan, who did The Shield on board, and he was like really, it just got his creative energies going, and he had the kind of clout where he could get it done. So there's no way you could capture that again. But because it was such a big success, it was cool because we went back and they optioned a lot of other stuff. And Inside Threat, just we were able to announce this week that it got a pretty big film option too, which will be, you know, wonderful if that works out. Because I was really picturing it as like the kind of 80s movies I grew up on. Yeah.
So would it be true, since you have a lot of experience here, that if you have one successful franchise, that the odds are you can have more? Or is it like a moonshot?
Not necessarily. Yeah, it's more of a moonshot. It's which makes no sense. So welcome to Hollywood. So many factors have to come together, and a lot of it is serendipity. The reason projects do or do not move forward, the studio might have a holding deal with some actor. That actor likes the book, and they need that actor to do something because they're paying him millions of dollars anyway. So it happens for that reason. There's all sorts. I had a pilot with NBC that was dead in the water. And then, but the executive who developed it, who developed all the other ones, got fired. And so all of a sudden ours was back alive again. Like, it makes no sense, no rhyme or reason. And it is a kind of a just luck when something does well. Like, if you have Sean Ryan, who's one of the best TV writers in the last 20, 30 years, that's a huge asset, and then you have the book to start with. So it's wonderful projects die all the time, terrible projects move forward all the time. You know, I was very lucky to be a baby writer on Seinfeld, and I was there from the very beginning, and NBC hated the show, absolutely hated it. And the only reason they didn't cancel it is because there was an acting president of NBC, because the real president was sick in the hospital. And the president who was sick in the hospital, his wife liked the show. So it was kind of untouchable in a way. And at least that's the rumor I've heard. And I was there. So not until the show was on for 3 years did NBC admit that they were wrong and that the show was good. So you never know.
There's a very big, I won't mention it by name, but there is a very huge TV franchise, and it does rest on the fact that the wife of the principal really liked the books. Right. So sometimes, you know, it's who you know. Sometimes
I could guess what it is, but I'm
yes,
not going to.
You probably can't. and sometimes it's getting an actor can get attached, right? I mean, I know that when Jack Carr was here, he was talking about the fact that he had a friend who knew Chris Pratt. Which Chris is it? There are three Chris's Pratt, in the play here. Chris Pratt. And so he took the Terminalist to Chris Pratt, and Chris Pratt liked it. And he had enough clout, you know, to say sometimes it's attracting. And remember, poor Doug Preston, who when he wrote the book about the Monster of Florence, you know, which was... And George Clooney, you know, loved it and wanted to, you know, signed on for it. It was all going to be great. And then I can't remember, he got distracted by something or he had some other contract, whatever. And, you know, and then it just died, you know. And that's the trouble when it's that personal. There's not really much recourse if it's like one person who, you know, wants to get it done. And that person, for whatever reason, goes away. So, you know, the stories of what makes it or what doesn't. I was checking to make sure The Night Agent was actually 1, 2, 3 books ago.
Yeah.
Because you've written 2 since.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that it wasn't, you know, an immediate book, but rather an older book that finally took off.
And as far as these things go, you know, I count that as pretty quick, that it, you know, took a year or two to get optioned and then another year or two to get made. Because, I mean, look how long it took to get all these wonderful Michael Connelly series.
Yeah, you about know. 25 books in.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, that's interesting because they had to overcome the success of The Lincoln Lawyer with Matthew McConaughey in order to recast it because, you know, he didn't want to do television forever in one role. And it was a little weird to watch the first, which is not based on the first book, The Lincoln Lawyer, but the second book. And it took a little while to get used to the new guy, but I really like him.
Yeah. Is that a David Kelly show? I think it might be. He makes great shows.
Yeah. Right. No, it's a terrific.
And Dennis Lehane is working with David Kelly on things now, too.
Yeah. Dennis is much more interested in the moment than script writing.
So, I know. I had a talk with him at BoucherCon, but it didn't stick.
It's nice
well,
to have a...
I've had that talk with Megan Abbott, too. Like, don't go to the place that's going to water down your voice. Stay in the book world.
Yeah.
But they didn't listen. But Megan just has a new book out. So, and she Dennis's
does.
New book is wonderful, I think. Yeah. But
well, when we actually had a conversation with Dennis, and he talked about the fact that script writing is so much easier than writing a novel, then he has more time for his young family. And also, because it's not filled with interior thoughts and other things, he can write it in situations where if he were writing a book, he'd have to lock himself up.
That's
but
very
he could
true.
Write, he could write a script, he said, if he were on the 50th yard line at the Super Bowl, and he wouldn't, you know, lose any momentum. But that's how Dennis's mind works, and it's not necessarily that true that would be. So tell us about script writing. You're the guy who, you didn't actually write the script,
no,
did
I've
you?
Like tried to adapt some things to have a sample, and it's a fascinating exercise. But Matt's the pro.
Yeah,
right.
It's much very different from writing a book. There are things that overlap. I think dialogue, creating characters, relationships, series architecture, story to a large degree. But when you're writing a script, you know there can only be so many pages, and it's really like making a blueprint. If you're a novelist, you design a house and you build it and you decorate it and you put all the stuff in it and the pictures on the wall and everything. If you're a script writer, you do the blueprint, and then all these other visions come in to realize what that will be. And that's just the nature. It's not a bad thing. It's just, you know, each actor is going to bring something different to that character. The set designer is going to bring something. The set decorator is going to bring something. The wardrobe person is going to bring something. The lighting person is. The sound design. The music. It's much more of a collaborative effort, and then you have a lot of bosses, because you're right. It is so expensive. The studios and the networks or streaming platforms, whoever you're working for. It's really expensive to make a television show now or a movie, and it costs almost nothing to make a book, physically to make it, relative to that. So it's a lot easier for a publisher to take a chance on a voice when it's paper and ink and shipping than it is for a television studio to make something that will employ hundreds and hundreds of people and cost millions and millions of dollars. But
that's an interesting industry. I mean, it started in New Jersey. We all think it's Hollywood, but it actually started in New Jersey with Edison. And then it got to Hollywood because they were trying to break Edison's monopoly, the way I remember it.
Well, also they didn't have good lights back then, so they wanted to shoot outside, and it hardly ever rains in Southern California, at least in Los Angeles.
Didn't used to. Now it does.
Yeah, And so it was, and it was easy to light, and they had way more shooting days than they did.
Sure. Well, they didn't have sound stages like they do now, so it had to be out in the open. It's actually a fascinating story to read about the machinations of Edison, who really wasn't a nice person, and who tried very hard to stifle. You know, I think the earliest movies were actually made in New Jersey, if
yeah,
I remember.
That's true.
Right. Yeah.
We're finally getting rid of his light bulbs. It's taken a long time.
I got some great advice kind of starting out because my friend's dad had done both. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, if it's what you like, and I like writing books, and I mean, I would love to write screenplays too, but, you know, writing books is kind of the best quality of life job. And then, to go to like the night agent set and to see what an undertaking it is. And then if you're a writer, you're kind of typically going up the ladder toward being a showrunner.
Yeah.
And then the showrunner is like a colonel, because you go, and the night agent was on an insane asylum in Vancouver, and there were hundreds of people there. And this person was in charge of this like $50 million budget and getting this all done, and it was like a military operation, and it was fun for me to check it out. And then like a fight scene took 14 hours to film. It's so labor intensive, it's maddening. And then they broke the set down and at midnight went into the tunnels under the old mental institution children's wing to set up a new thing, and were there till 2 or 3 in the morning. It was like collective madness.
And it's the showrunner is a writer, and so that person has to have this sensibility to sit in a room by themselves, create something out of nothing, put it on the blank page, and then also have the managerial ability to run a show, and has to have a salesperson ability to sell all of that up the ladder to the networks and studios to get it approved, and to all your creative people to get everyone on board. It's a really hard job.
Yeah, no, it definitely sounds it. So, you know, it seems to me that, because we've also talked to people who are script writers who became novelists,
right,
such as you, and that can be really hard, because if you're a script writer, you've mostly focused on dialogue. And, you know, as you say, the blueprint,
right,
and then you have to fill it in as a novelist. I noticed that the second season of Dark Winds, the Tony Hillerman books, is going to come out on July 30th. But for those of you with a long memory, they tried to make Tony Hillerman a couple of novels into films. And because it's mostly interior, because it was mostly landscape description or what went on inside the heads of Joe Leaporn and everybody, it just didn't translate, you know, to film. But now they've done a whole new approach to it.
Didn't it take Robert Redford like 20 years to get that made or something?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's Robert Redford and George R.R. Martin finally put their money together and said...
It takes someone who's really passionate about the book and really gets the book. The Coen brothers did it with No Country for Old Men. It's been done with the John le Carré books, which are very internal and talky at times.
They really are. And I can still remember Alec Guinness and The Spy That Came In from McCall. God, it was, you know, I think it was in the 80s or something that came out. And it was so exciting.
I'm trying to get
people
a copy of that. Of all the British, especially the Smiley books, the Smiley trilogy. But they're not available for streaming, and all the DVDs only work on the British system. Yeah.
Well, you know, we can go all the way back into the history of film and you know, nitrate film that caught fire, and how many, that's one of the, you know, the treasure hunts in fiction is, you know, like a lost movie or a lost cut, because the film, so much of it was combustible and just didn't last.
Yeah.
All sorts of cool things. Right. So what are you working on now, Matthew?
I'm working on the next book, which is another standalone. It's kind of early stages, but the premise is you have a woman who is a TV actress, and she typically plays, kind of because she has dark hair and sad eyes, she plays kind of badass women, and like often tough things happen to them. But in real life, that's very different from her personality. And then she's in New York. And then her friend goes missing, almost like a Taken kind of thing. And so she goes looking for her, gets sucked into the world of kind of diplomacy and espionage. And then it's fun because she has to become like the characters she's played, because she's done all the training and martial arts and weapons, you know, for stage. And the question is, can she really get that done in real life? And
so she can she become a ninja?
Yeah. So that's like, that's kind of the journey she'll go on, not to spoil anything, but yeah, that's obviously where it's going. Yeah. So that's, I'm in the midst of that one, and it's fun so far.
Sounds wonderful. And what are you working on?
I'm working on a book that'll be out next May. Just, I'm doing the second draft of it. It's about these two estranged siblings who grew up in a resort in northern Minnesota. They're Irish twins. They're 11 months apart. And one lives in New York now, and one lives in L.A. And the book starts with, they get a phone call that they're, and to find out that their older brother has just died of a seizure. He's 13 years older. And the older brother's widow calls and tells them that he passed away. And about 5 minutes after they get off the phone, each of the siblings gets an email at the same time from their dead brother. And it says, if I die, no matter what it looks like, it wasn't natural, I was murdered. And the how that happened was, he thought someone was trying to kill him, the older brother. And so he scheduled the email that says, I was murdered, to be sent the next day. And every day he woke up and wasn't murdered, he moved it to the next day. So when he was murdered, it's sent. And so these two estranged siblings kind of come together at the funeral and decide to investigate their brother's claims.
So, and not a Neil Shapiro.
No. I'm the number one question I get is, when are you going to write another Nils book? And I think I will definitively say, pretty soon, one way or the other. But my publisher, Forge, just released Gone to Dust in trade paperback for the first time, and the other three books are coming in the next year. So I hope that will regenerate enough interest. The problem is that Carolina Moonset, that came out last year, has sold very well. So it's in its sixth printing now. So they don't, I mean, obviously my publisher likes that, but most people
want to make money.
They
sure
do, and they should want to make money. And my answer to them is, I want to write two books a year, a Nils book and a standalone. And so hopefully that can happen.
I hope so. I really loved Neil Shapiro. I've been crazy about them all the way through.
Yeah, I miss him.
The second one is another fabulous premise. And, you know, part of it is Minnesota specific. Yeah. And, you know, there used to be a ton of writers in Minnesota. You remember that? It was like Minneapolis.
There still are. I mean, yeah, William Kent Kruger, Alan Eskins.
I know, but not as many as there, I think, at one point.
Well, John Sanford left.
That's right. He lives in Santa Fe.
He lives in Santa Fe. And apparently Brian Freeman left.
To Florida.
To Florida. But Kent Kruger, Mindy Mejia, right. Marcy Rendon. There's good writers there. Yeah.
There are good writers there. Marcy Rendon writes really interesting books.
Yes.
A little bit in the Tony Hillerman vein. They're set on the Red River, which, if I remember right, is the only river in the United States that flows north into Hudson Bay. So it's a really interesting, it's up in the northwest part of
It's between Minnesota and the Dakotas.
Right, and North Dakota.
And she's Native American, and so she brings that voice
like
in, which is great.
I think they're really interesting. Yeah. Yeah, right. And I'm also hoping that The Private Investigator is making a bit of a comeback, because
I hope,
you know,
so
they
too.
Were kind of dead. And part of that, and I found this is great, we were talking about that when I was doing a spy. This is our week of 14 authors. It's really, so just before this, I did an event with Joe Cannon and Alana Berry, and we didn't talk about it, and I should have raised it, but spy novels in part are going back to old school, because everything digital can be hacked now. Mm-hmm. And so spy novels are beginning to revive, like The Drop, you know, or the you know, meeting on the park bench, or the, you know, message in the tree or something like that.
And that's a real thing.
It is a real thing. No, absolutely. Yeah. But I think it's going to reinvigorate the spy novel, because it's not really that interesting to read about all digital you know, espionage stuff.
Yeah, you know, with there's, the keyboard guy.
Yeah, there's not enough character in it, whatever. And I'm also thinking that, you know, that the private investigator may
I have a theory about that. I think in this, I mean, obviously in the 40s and 50s, there was kind of a counterculture, or just like, a, I think for the general population, a peer into the underworld, which Chandler and Hammett did really well. And then there was a counterculture thing in the 60s and 70s that, at least on TV, Rockford captured a bit. And then after 9/11, everything kind of went authority and became about police and military. And then now in the last 5-6 years, half the country hates the government, no matter who's there. So I think the counterculture is coming back a little bit.
An interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, that might be it. Also, it's, you know, not that interesting to have a book that's all about fabulous forensics, and less in the way of human deduction and all the rest of it. So
yeah, it was good when Mark Twain did it with Pudd'nhead Wilson. That's when fingerprints first came into. But ever since then, it's been
Right. So questions from any of you? We've left you speechless. Ah, a question. Yes, sir.
For Matt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Baby Rider on Seinfeld and some other studios or shows that you were involved with?
Yeah, I worked on a lot of shows. I did that for 30 years. So,
was Seinfeld that long?
No, I wasn't on Seinfeld that long. I was on Seinfeld a couple of years. Yeah, I worked on Ellen, the sitcom, not the talk show, The New Adventures of Old Christine. A lot of shows, some good, some not so good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Did you like making the jump to writing novels, or did you write a novel and then go, which way did it go?
No. I had a break, between TV shows for a few months, and I was splitting my time between Minneapolis and Los Angeles. And I was in Minneapolis and it was winter and it was super cold out. And I had been reading a lot of crime fiction because I wanted to move from comedy to drama. And after reading it for a few years, I had that break and I thought, I'm just gonna see if I can write one of these. And that's what Gone to Dust is. And I'm much happier as a novelist than I was as a TV writer, even though I make less.
What Matt brings to his books is that, you know, he has that comedic sense. They're really fun, but he's also very good on tight plotting. And so all of his books have absolutely terrific plots and can really, this one, I have to say, really foxed me. I did not see where this book was going. I only wish we could talk about it. I really did not know where it was. Well, we can't. But I was really surprised. And I think, you know, good for you.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And I love Carolina Moonset, which we haven't talked about.
No, that was, we did
last
year. Tell
us a little bit about that.
Well, Carolina Moonset is set in Beaufort, South Carolina. And really,
it's warm. It's warm in Beaufort, South Carolina.
Yes. And what I knew Beaufort because my mom's side of the family is from there. So I've been going there my whole life. And it's a very beautiful place. When the Northern Army marched down after during the Civil War, they burned a lot of towns, but they left Beaufort alone. So all that pre-antebellum charm is there. But what inspired that book is my dad suffered from Lewy body disease, which is a form of dementia. And like most people who suffer from it, he lost his short-term memory, but not his long-term memory. So he couldn't. And he was a huge talker, very extroverted, and he always wanted to talk about something like news or weather or sports, but he couldn't remember those things because they were current events. So he started telling stories from his childhood that I had never heard before and stories from my childhood that I had never heard before. And it was really kind of a silver lining to his disease. And a few years after he died, I thought, you know, that's kind of an interesting way into a mystery. Someone who's talking about the past tells a story and brings up a mystery that the family never knew about. And then something happens in the present in which the dad is a suspect and he has no idea if he's guilty and he doesn't know what he did. And so his son, Joey, has to kind of, the police are really trying to get the evidence to arrest his dad, and Joey has to try to figure out what happened to clear his dad's name.
Yeah, it's a generational small town memory. Oh, it's a great book, really wonderful book. I can see why it's also well.
Yeah.
Right. But I'd love it if you could write two a year. That
yeah,
would be very
I know I can write two a year. I just wrote another one.
We just need
one.
To talk fortune to it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully.
Right. All right. So anybody else have a question? Yeah.
Well, I have a question for both. But, okay. So it sounds like your script writing was comedy.
Most of it was, yeah.
So is that why you really shifted towards doing like the thriller? Because you didn't want to do...
Well, comedy was moving in a direction that I was not loving. It was becoming a little more slick and a little jokier. And I like comedy that explores our human faults. I mean, I think that's why we love it. I mean, they say Seinfeld is a show about nothing. I think it's about selfishness. Those are the most selfish characters on the planet. We all feel those selfish impulses. What makes that show funny is they actually act on them. But I was missing that humanity when I wanted to move to drama. I'd always been a big reader, but not much crime fiction. I started reading crime fiction for research, actually. And I found, oh, you know what? When there's a crime at the center of your story, when there's a dead body and clues keep coming along, there's kind of a built-in engine to the story. And your characters don't have to carry the whole weight of it because... you know, the phone's going to ring and say, we got the prints off the gun or whatever happens. And that gave me what I was missing from comedy was like, oh, there's these moments for you can really get into their lives and their relationships in crime fiction. And that's what drew me to it.
You both have a great sense of timing. I mean, I do think that that's one thing I've always loved about both your books is your previous writing experience, well, you know, gave you that.
So you had a question for
me. Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Well, kind of in that, as far as, so how long did you write for the newspaper?
About 7 years. And then the whole time I was working on a book. And, you know, it started, because my personality, I actually thought of being a comedy writer, you know? And I tried out for the Lampoon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. And then I made like the first cut and they're like, come back. And I said, I need something for my resume. So I went to the school newspaper and then got into journalism. But my personality is not, you know, you have the guys who come in here and they like fly planes and shoot guns all weekend. And so I'm not like a natural weekend thriller character guy. But it was funny because I wrote the book. I worked on a manuscript forever, and it started out being more like almost a Christopher Buckley, like Thank You for Smoking kind of book, like almost a satire. And then I added thriller elements just to have a plot. And people said, you know, these are good and these stink. So, you know, slowly I kind of steered that ship around. So that first book took me like 5 or 6 years, but by the end I knew what I wanted to do and done every mistake in it, so I got that all out of my
But
system.
We both came up in mediums where brevity was prized.
I've read about, you know, sitcom plotting, and this is why I love novels, because in film it's got to be 110, 120 pages, and sitcom plotting, if you look at, maybe it's like changed, but there's like 2 or 3 plots per episode. There's like 30 seconds per beat, and it's
really
so
tight. Yeah.
And I mean, you're just, it has a lot of constraints, and I'm kind of in awe of how people can put those together. But I like a novel where I can just, you know, just, it's easier. You can do whatever you want and kind of go anywhere, and no one says like, all right, we'll squeeze this down to 22 pages.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it does save you from being so prolix that, you know, people are bored.
Well, I don't really have that problem, you know?
No, I know.
Yeah.
That's my point.
Just because I like the action kind of stuff.
Yeah, but yeah. I meant the, you know, you don't write long.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I meant.
Oh, yeah, the journalism background. Yeah, because they would just, I walked in to the editor's office, and I was a junior guy, and I was always trying to get articles. And they'd be like, well, we bumped your article. And I'd say, who for? And they'd say, well, Salman Rushdie. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, of course. And then one day I walked in, the editor, he was like looking at the Atlantic, and everybody writes long, everybody thinks they're genius, and he's like, all these effing words, all these words, you know, and I was trying to get my words in, you know. Yeah. So it did teach me to be really tight.
I mean,
with
you
things.
Know, that old saw about, you know, if I had more time, I'd have written shorter.
Yeah.
Right.
Is actually true.
Yes.
You know, it's harder to tear things down to their essence than, you know, it takes more time.
Yeah, and that's why TV writing and especially the comedy writing seems so hard, because everything has to be perfect.
And I started as a stand-up, and when you're crafting a joke, you are looking in a thesaurus to find a shorter version of the same word. I mean, you're pulling every syllable you can to get to deliver it in the most efficient way possible.
Proving that I don't watch TV anymore. Yeah. Are there sitcoms still going strong, or has it kind of died away?
Well, there are half-hour comedies, but what a lot of people think of as, Abbott Elementary is kind of a traditional sitcom that does very well and is very good, but most of them are more hybrid dramedy type shows now. I think so, but I don't watch them either, so I don't know.
Yes, sir.
Question for Matthew.
Yeah.
So you wrote The Night Agent, mm-hmm. and then somebody comes along and says, "We want to put this on TV," and you hand it off to them. And I'm assuming you don't have any control from that point on.
I don't have any contractual yes, no power. And it all depends. So in this case, the showrunner, Sean Ryan, was just a wonderful guy. So he sent me the pilot script, and which he didn't really need to, and said, you know, I just wanted to make sure I had sort of done right by this. And I thought, well, this is a trip for me, because you're this legendary writer. He was also a co-executive producer on Terriers, which was set in my funky little neighborhood in Ocean Beach in San Diego. This is a little fun small world thing. And so he was just really gracious about everything, and I read it, and I liked it a lot. And then we talked about the characters. And then, in later press interviews, he said that was helpful to him. But a lot of it was that I was really fortunate to have a showrunner who I really respected. And I just said, Sean Ryan, take the wheel kind of thing. And said, I'm happy to help as much as possible or stay out of your way. And then they went off and wrote it. And I didn't really... And then I got to go visit the set, which was really cool. I got to go do the fun stuff.
Do you have an Alfred Hitchcock moment? I'm trying to remember.
No, I said... It was my first time on set, so I was very, didn't want to get in.
You don't want to trip on the cables.
Well, and I thought they treated writers like garbage, because that's kind of what they say.
Not in TV.
They treated me very well, and it was really nice. I was used to Barton Fink, you know?
That was film.
Yeah. They treated me really well, and I was like, oh, this is weird. And then I said, it was funny, because... When I was first there, I was nervous, but you're on set for 14 hours. So you get that punchy energy of when you're waiting at the airport, because it's all waiting. So it was a nice way to get to know people, because there's so much downtime. And I have photos of by the end, I had the fake Secret Service agent stabbing me with a fake knife and was goofing around. And I said, and by the end, I was like, can I be in something, they said they had no crowd scenes during the filming block. Yeah. So I couldn't be in anything. But that's fine, and I get to be more of a prima donna on the next ones. Cause The Night Agent did well.
What is the next one? Can you tell us?
Oh, who knows? The whole industry is paused, but it's a nice situation where, because of the success of The Night Agent, basically everything else got picked up. And then.
So the odds are better that one of them will get made.
I think so, but
Yeah.
You can't account for it.
Well, let's hope so. Anybody else have a question? Oh, Patrick, any from the online audience?
And what's the name of his book?
He was 5 years older, so he was in my brother's class, my oldest brother's class. And I know he had a book called Drone Kings, and I know he's working on a historical thriller. But his name is Chris Albanese. Yeah, he does like the Crew Book Reviews podcast. And he's a terrific guy and a good writer. So yeah, he had the fun stuff of like, you know, the Secret Service, they're basically cops. So they have a lot of the fun cop dark humor. And he gave me the slang of like an older agent's called a hair bag and all that kind of stuff. And so I worked that in.
Is there actually a night agent? Is that a real thing?
Yeah. Yeah. He gave me the shirt. So my friend in DC, I knew he worked for the FBI, and he would disappear every night at 10 o'clock. We were like 24, because in DC, young people weirdly do all the work.
Like, yeah, I was an intern there one summer.
Yeah. So like the binder, the kid spends all Easter weekend doing the binder, and then they give it to the person. And so a great job, but a horrible job at the FBI is like an overnight watch or a briefer, because in his case, he would do the overnight watch and then brief Robert Mueller, the FBI director. So you had like a 25-year-old or however old he was, getting FaceTime every morning with the FBI director, which is like jumping 15 levels. And all I knew is that my cool FBI friend would disappear every night. And I just imagined him, what became the book, kind of waiting by an emergency phone, which is kind of a real thing. And then I just spun it out from there, you know? And then, weirdly, he later went into more finance, and then his company bought Sargent and Greenleaf, which, like, in the books, there's always this, like, government safe cracking and lock picking and stuff, and they're the big, they make all the government safe. So in all my books, somebody's breaking into a Sargent and Greenleaf, and he goes, so the night agent, my friend, the real life night agent, he's like, oh yeah, we own them now. And I said, great, send me a shirt. They're in all my books.
Product placement. I love it. Sergeant Greenlee, it actually is. You could do that with scotch or something and get some.
Yeah, I don't want him to send me a safe.
Yeah.
Oh, please. What is it? Something Cadillac 30 was, what was it called? 38K? 32 Cadillac. Oh, God. It was one of the truly great heist novels of all time. And Joe Gorse actually worked in Repo for a while. And so he has this gypsy group that, it's really one of the truly great heist novels.
Did I ever do the handcuffs and lockpicks here? For a while, I was
you did. Yeah, with one of your events here.
I would pick locks and handcuffs, and I took a class where I got kidnapped in L.A., and they, like, tase you and throw you in the back of a van and chase you around L.A. And
it's kind of a Harry Houdini thing.
Yeah. And, so, I mean, it's fun to do that stuff, but then it always ends up being too long in the book.
That's the problem with research. You want to put it in there, and it usually bores people to death. Yeah.
Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening.
You.
Let's give our authors a round of applause. Yay.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.